customary international law is puzzling in a way treaties aren't. Treaties are contracts, and the source of the obligations they impose on states, as well as their content, presents no special legal problem. If there is a puzzle about how treaties can bind states, it's a general puzzle about how contracts can legally bind promisors. By comparison, the status of customary international law is controversial. Customary international law is created by the regular practice of states, and the extent of consensus required for a custom to exist is vague. Similarly, because customary international law does not have the canonical form of a treaty or statute, its content is uncertain. Even the extent to which states act merely in accordance with norms, rather than from a sense of obligation, is unknown and understudied. May a state unilaterally withdraw from a treaty to which it's a party when the treaty doesn't otherwise so provide? Are states obligated not to arbitrarily detain people or subject them to degrading treatment? May a successor state repudiate the odious debts of the preceding state? Because customary international law is created by the regular practice among states, not by the state's lawmakers, its legal validity is not self-evident. Three questions, therefore, can be asked in connection with its legal status. First, what are the norms of customary international law governing the conduct of states or their citizens? Second, are states legally bound by it? And third, does customary international law apply domestically without incorporation by domestic law? I will argue that there are other sorts of questions that don't need to be asked about customary international law, namely jurisprudential questions. It's often thought that judicial recognition of customary international law depends on jurisprudential assumptions about the nature of law, legal norms, and legal validity. This is a mistake. The limits of judicial reliance on customary international law are constitutional or evidentiary, not jurisprudential. Jurisprudential views about law, which are analytic in character, have nothing to say about the questions I've just flagged. Now, my argument is in three steps. The first step is a claim about Erie Railroad versus Tompkins. Although Erie fairly can be read to require domestic authorization for customary international law to have domestic legal effect, the case and its reasoning do not rely on commitments to a theory of law, including legal positivism. The second step is the effect that reliance on positivism has an unwelcome consequence for the binding character of customary international law. The third step in the argument is that conceptions of law or legal validity can ground different views about the relation between international and domestic law. Positions on the priority of customary international law, therefore, are determined by views about that relation, not by views on the source of or about the source of its authority. Taken together, these considerations suggest that jurisprudence isn't needed to answer the questions courts and other legal authorities ask about customary international law's content, the legal obligations it creates, and its domestic legal effect. So the first step, the requirement that customary international law must have domestic authorization to have domestic legal effect goes through Erie. According to Erie, federal courts have no power to make general common law. Absent constitutional or congressional authorization to make law, a federal court must apply state law as decided by the state's highest court. Erie's requirement of federal or state authorization is frequently thought to depend on legal positivism. As a result, the domestic status of customary international law also is taken to rely on the same view about the nature of law. Because Erie requires a legal rule to have authoritative federal or state source, customary international law has no domestic application unless it is authorized by federal or state law. It's understandable that Erie might be thought to rely on legal positivism. The opinion itself says as much. After basing the limitation on a federal court's power to make general common law on statutory construction and policy, Justice Brandeis comes to the constitutional objection to the power. The, quote, the fallacy underlying the view that federal courts have general common law making power, he says, is the assumption of a wrong theory of law. Quoting approvingly Justice Holmes's dissent in Kuhn versus Fairmount Cole, the assumption is that there is a, quote, in the famous phrase, a transcendental body of law outside any particular state but obligatory within it unless and until changed by statute. The correct theory of law, instead, is one which holds, quote, law in the sense in which courts speak of it today does not exist without some definite authority behind it, unquote. This is Holmes's then unexceptional version of legal positivism. Now, the closeness and proximity between this observation and the constitutional objection in the opinion makes it appear that the objection has a partly jurisprudential basis. In fact, positivism is a superfluous premise in Erie's rationale and its constitutional holding. Positivism is a view about the nature of law. It's a claim about what makes a norm a legal norm and makes it part of a legal system. In its most general form, positivism holds that law consists of social facts of a particular sort. Versions of positivism differ according to the social facts on which law depends, as well as how these facts explain law. The classic form of the theory is that a state's law consists only in what its legal officials declare as binding. In John Austin's version of legal positivism, law consists in the coercive orders of a sovereign and its agents. This is the version that Holmes states in his dissent in Kuhn and that Brandeis approvingly recites in Erie. Positivism is superfluous to Erie and therefore also to the domestic status of customary international law if it is independent of Erie's holding. It is independent of the holding if positivism is neither sufficient nor necessary for the holding. It's easy to show that positivism is insufficient for Erie's holding. Assume that positivism is true, then all legally valid norms must have a federal or state source of authority. Erie's holding limiting federal judicial lawmaking power still could be wrong. This is because positivism's truth is consistent with a variety of different constitutional roles for federal courts. Article III's grant of diversity jurisdiction might authorize the federal courts to make independent judgments about state law. Admiralty jurisdiction is understood to give lawmaking authority, and diversity jurisdiction might do the same. Alternatively, Article III might give federal courts authority to create general federal common law, a national common law based on the same sources of law as state common law, while being neither state law nor federal law for Article VI's purposes. Different courts understood Swift versus Tyson's recognition of the judicial power to make general federal law in a diversity case in these different ways. If these courts were wrong, their error is in the interpretation of Article III, not because their interpretation is inconsistent with legal positivism. As far as positivism goes, Article III could authorize a general federal lawmaking power. Thus, positivism by itself doesn't assign any particular lawmaking role to federal courts. Those who think that Erie and positivism are connected in some way do not likely believe that positivism is sufficient for Erie's holding. More likely, it's thought that positivism is necessary for Erie's holding. But positivism also is unnecessary to the holding. To see this, notice again that positivism is a theory about law, a view about the conditions norms must satisfy to be legal norms. Positivism maintains that social facts necessarily determine the legal status of norms. Suppose, however, that moral facts, not social facts, necessarily determine their legal status. In this case, positivism is false. For instance, a natural law theory might require norms to be consistent with natural law or reason to be law. Although this is a storybook version of natural law theory, it's a coherent view. Nonetheless, Erie's limitation on federal judicial lawmaking still could apply in a legal system whose norms had the required moral content. In this system, a federal court would need authority to create norms, even when the norms created are consistent with morality. Thus, even if positivism is false, Erie's limitation on judicial lawmaking still can apply. Positivism, therefore, is not necessary for Erie's result. The reason is that Erie's holding is narrow. It's limited to the constraints that the U.S. Constitution imposes on the power of federal courts. Because these constraints are constitutional and peculiar to a particular legal system, they don't apply to other legal systems in which the same constitutional constraints do not operate. Erie's requirement that law have an authoritative source in federal or state law is a requirement in a particular legal system with particular constitutional constraints. Thus, Erie's holding depends only on constitutional allocations of lawmaking authority in this legal system. By contrast, positivism is again a theory of law, a view about the conditions that hold for legal norms in all logically, or perhaps sociologically possible legal systems. Because the constitutional provisions can vary across legal systems, positivism might be false while Erie's holding remains correct. Now, Erie's logic doesn't require a commitment to positivism. Whether positivism somehow predisposed or otherwise influenced acceptance of Erie's holding is a different question. This is a historical question about the causal influence of subscribing to a particular conception of law. Causation is supported by instances in which, among other things being equal, non-positivists disputed Erie's holding. Now, ideally, an experiment in which legal observers are randomly assigned to treatment and control groups could be designed to settle the question. Those in the treatment groups could be divided into two subgroups, a group instructed in non-positivist theories of law, and a group receiving instruction in positivism. The relative frequency with which, on average, members of each group come to accept Erie's holding measures the causal impact of jurisprudential theories on belief in the holding. Just think of it, the beginning of a behavioral jurisprudence. Now, obviously, this randomized experiment is infeasible and the causal inference it supports unavailable. The evidence supporting a causal inference instead must be indirect and historical. Although the causal impact of beliefs about positivism is an empirical matter, the evidence available doesn't suggest a causal connection. A believer in a non-positivist theory of law could subscribe to the result in Erie too. He might be convinced that there are constitutional limits on lawmaking authority of federal courts in diversity cases. Or he might prefer more progressive state common law and believe that state court judges were more likely than federal judges to produce progressive state common law. Or the non-positivist might be convinced that the risk of local prejudice no longer justified independent federal rules of decision. Whatever influence positivism has on the belief in the limits on federal judicial lawmaking can come from factors unrelated to views about the nature of law. Now for the second step in the argument. Committing Erie to positivism not only misunderstands the case's rationale, it has an unwelcome consequence for customary international law. Customary international law is either not binding on governments, or the conception of positivism that makes it binding on them is arbitrarily selected. Erie's commitment to positivism means that federal and state law must be the result of what lawmaking officials declare to be the law. Law consists in the coercive orders issued by a sovereign, according to the classical version of positivism. If customary international law requires the same authority, it's not binding on governments and therefore not law. Alternatively, if customary international law is binding on governments, a different notion of legal authority in law applies to obligate governments than applies at the domestic level. In this case, the notions of authority and law are ad hoc, selected to preserve the obligatory nature of customary international law. Thus, prevalent international state practices either don't bind governments or bind them based on an arbitrarily selected conception of law. Both alternatives are unacceptable, and let's just consider them in turn. Take the first. Suppose Erie relies on positivism as a theory of law. The version of positivism it relies on is classical positivism. This, again, is the view that law consists of the orders of a sovereign backed by force. Law for Holmes, as he says, is the articulate voice of some sovereign or quasi-sovereign that can be identified, unquote. Holmes here adopts John Austin's version of positivism, and neither Holmes nor Brandeis seem inclined to qualify or amend the account of law. Because general federal common law is common law, the authority to create it must have a sovereign source in either constitutional or congressional enactments. Finding no constitutional or congressional authority, Holmes and Brandeis conclude that there is no general federal common law. The fact that it also has no source in other sorts of social practices is superfluous. The same reasoning applied to customary international law concludes that governments are not bound by customary international law either. Nations are sovereign with respect to their populations. Because nations are not subject to coercive orders of other nations, they are sovereign with respect to each other. Thus, rules between nations based on state practice can't have the status of law. They cannot therefore create legal obligations for governments. Now, classical positivists drew exactly this conclusion. For them, customary international law, strictly speaking, is a misnomer. John Austin, as John Austin called it, customary international law, what he referred to as the law of nations, is law improperly so-called, his phrase. Although these rules demand the compliance of nations, the rules don't count as law. They have no legal status because they are not backed by effective sanctions. A nation might resolve to comply with customary international law, but absent rules of state behavior backed by sanctions for non-compliance, these rules lack a sovereign source and therefore are not law. Domestic law might incorporate customary international law so that its requirements are given effect by being enforced domestically. In this case, the requirements become law for those subject to them. However, they don't bind the government. In T.E. Holland's fairly famous phrase, law of nations is, as he puts it, the vanishing point of jurisprudence. Now, for a dualist about international law, positivism presents a problem. Dualism about customary international law distinguishes customary international law from domestic law. Customary international law and domestic law are parts of distinct legal systems, so that customary international law is not self-executing. It becomes part of domestic law only by implementing legislation or other means by which it is recognized domestically. Customary international law therefore becomes part of domestic law when incorporated into it. The problem is with its status as domestic as international law binding on the government. If the classical conception of positivism underlies Erie's holding, the same conception must apply to both domestic and international law. But applied, quote, outwardly to international law, customary international law loses its status as law. This is because nations, as independent sovereigns, aren't subject to the coercive orders of other nations. The rules reflected in regular state behavior that comprise customary international law don't have coercive sanctions attached to noncompliance. They are not coercive orders issued by nations sovereign over the potentially noncompliant nation. Thus, customary international law is law improperly so-called, even at the national level. Its demands, therefore, do not legally bind governments outwardly in their relation with other governments. This is a consequence that dualists about customary international law must find unacceptable because they assume that customary international law binds governments. So let's take up the next alternative. To avoid the conclusion that customary international law is law improperly so-called, a different version of positivism applicable at the international level might be adopted. The version needed to leave customary international law binding at the national level is one that finds law in social facts other than coercive sanctions. H.L.A. Hart's conventionalist account of positivism is a well-known version of positivism that does this. According to Hart, law is social practice of a particular sort, a convergent practice among officials by which they apply the same conclusive criteria for a norm to be law in the community. Hart calls the rule that describes the conclusive criteria they use the rule of recognition. The rule specifies how to identify legal norms. Now, in everything but name, the rule of recognition is customary law. The law of the community consists of both the rule of recognition and the norms that satisfy it. On Hart's account, a legal system exists when there is a rule of recognition and the rules valid under it are generally followed by those subject to them. Unlike classical positivism, the social facts relevant to law are not coercive orders. Instead, they are a convergent behavior of officials in which officials use the same criteria of validity to test rules and evaluate other officials' behavior. The details of Hart's version of positivism are unimportant for my purposes. The only point needed is the claim that law is possible only when there is a social practice among officials in using a conclusive rule for validating norms as law. For this claim to be true, it's not necessary to determine the character of this practice, for instance, whether the behavior involved in the practice must be conventional or merely convergent. It's enough that the practice need not involve commands to which coercive sanctions are attached. If law consists in a social practice among officials of using certain criteria of validity, along with rules that are valid according to the criteria, which are generally followed by the population to which they apply, legal norms need not be coercive in nature. Thus, Hart's account of law, unlike classical positivism, does not count as law only coercive rules issued by a sovereign. Hart's practice version of positivism has difficulty accounting for international law, but that's really not my purpose here. Let's just suppose that Hart's account is correct in its broad outlines. It might be thought that Erie relies on a classical version of positivism, while the practice version of positivism validates customary international law at the international level. Erie requires that the domestic application of customary international law have a domestic sovereign source, while its application to nations might have an international source. This view retains Erie's supposed commitment to positivism while also preserving the dualist's position that customary international law binds nations. It's a quote-unquote mixed view in that different conceptions of positivism apply to domestic and international law. However, and here's the objection, the mixed view is ad hoc. It draws on two different theories of law in order to preserve dualism about customary international law. To see this, consider a passage in which Professor Weisbord invokes the practice conception of positivism at the international level. And here's what he says. The human authority that creates customary international law is the collective international community. That community makes law as positivistic, as those the states apply. Thus, applying rules developed under the authority of the international community hardly amounts to the resurrection of the concept of general law. Rather, such an approach incorporates the insight from Erie that human agency creates law and looks to the appropriate agency to determine a particular law's content. Now, there are two problems with Weisbord's position. One is identified by Professors Bradley and Goldsmith. Erie requires a domestic law source of authority, whether it's state or federal, for a federal court to apply customary international law. Because the international community by itself is not such a source, the court cannot rely on customary international law unless authorized by constitutional or statutory enactments. The second problem separate is that the conception of law of the excuse me that this conception of positivism invoked by Weisbord is ad hoc. His position implicitly invokes two different conceptions of positivism, one applicable internationally and the other domestically. Recognition of customary international law rules by nations can constitute law, according to the practice conception of positivism. However, Erie supposedly relies on a classical conception of positivism as a conception of law. This requires a sovereign authority whose directives are backed by effective sanctions. Otherwise, according to Erie, customary international law is not an authoritative source of law domestically, because the international community doesn't exercise effective control over domestic matters in the United States. Its norms are not by themselves domestic authority for federal courts. Thus, for customary international law rules to have legal authority both internationally and domestically, they must satisfy two different conceptions of law, the classical and the practice versions of positivism. It's arbitrary to rely on different conceptions of law at the domestic and international levels. A conception of law states conditions of legality that apply to any legal system. Its conditions don't change at the border. Of course, the same version of positivism could be applicable both domestically and internationally. However, classical positivism doesn't count customary international law norms as law and therefore is legally binding on states. This conception of law, therefore, is inconsistent with dualism about international law, which recognizes that states can be bound by customary international law. More plausible is the practice conception. It can consider customary international law rules to be law at both the domestic and international levels, as they might both be supported by state pressure for conformity and satisfy the rule of recognition operative in a domestic legal system. But reliance on this practice conception requires giving up the sort of positivism to which Erie is supposedly committed. Now, there's nothing in itself objectionable about concluding that a different conception of law underlies Erie's limitation on federal judicial lawmaking than the conception apparently relied on in the case. After all, Brandeis could simply have been wrong about the correct version of positivism. However, unlike classical positivism, the practice version of positivism does not limit the sort of authority recognized by the rule of recognition. Thus, it does not require that the power to make a federal rule decision be authorized by the Constitution or federal statute. A rule of recognition could count the rule as law even when not authorized by political actors. Constitutional restrictions instead alone put those limits on a federal court's authority to make law. This again shows that jurisprudential views about the nature of law are doing no work in Erie. It might be denied that the reliance on the Constitution avoids a commitment to a conception of law. After all, the Constitution itself might not be legal authority. To know whether it is legal authority, one has to know what counts as law. Someone might doubt that the Constitution is law. To eliminate her doubt, it must be shown that the Constitution can have legal authority. Demonstrating this requires a theory of law, an account of the features that give norms legal authority. So it might be denied that one can avoid relying on a conception of law. This denial misunderstands both the dispute in Erie and the justification of conceptions of law. The issue in Erie is not whether there is a constitutional limit on federal judicial lawmaking. Both advocates and opponents of the power of federal courts to create federal common law agree that this limit would be authoritative. They disagree only over whether the Constitution limits this power when it's not exercised based on congressional or other political authority. More important, the denial relies on an inappropriately high standard of justification. It demands a conclusive demonstration that the Constitution can be legally authoritative. The demand sets a higher standard for justification than is required for justification in other domains, including in law. The best evidence for climate change or evolution does not show, or purport to show, that it's impossible that atmospheric temperatures or the genetic characteristics of species remain unchanged. The evidence, if credited, makes it only very unlikely that temperatures or genetic change has not occurred over time. Increases in temperature or genetic changes haven't occurred over time. The demand and answer route to justification eventually leads to a continual regress or a circle. Eventually, the same demand to justify a constitutional consideration can be made of any other consideration, beginning the regress in justification. Alternatively, the authority that justifies a constitutional consideration itself relies on the Constitution, thereby making the justification circular. Consistently applied, the demand for a conclusive demonstration leads to skepticism about any purported source of legal authority. Third step in the argument. A final question about customary international law is whether it applies domestically without being incorporated by domestic law. For instance, suppose a contract between state A and state B includes a particular term and provides that A's law controls the agreement. The term is enforceable under state A's law, but invalid according to customary international law, which A has not incorporated into its law. Is customary international law self-executing so that notwithstanding A's law, the contract term is invalid? This conflict is often described as one involving two different ways of conceiving of the relation between domestic and international legal systems, monism and dualism about international law. Monism is the view that domestic and international law form a single legal order. International law, according to most monists, has a priority over domestic law, so that A's law includes customary international law without incorporation. Dualism views domestic and international legal systems as distinct orders, so that customary international law is effective domestically only if incorporated in accordance with domestic law. For dualists, domestic law has priority over international law. Monism is thought to support invalidating the term in A and B's contract, while dualism allows enforcement of the term. This way of describing the disagreement over whether customary international law is self-executing makes it seem as if the disagreement is conceptual in character. Monism and dualism disagree about the requirements a legal norm must satisfy to be valid. Monists believe that legally valid rules cannot bind those subject to them to conflicting requirements, as can occur if international and domestic legal rules are part of different legal systems. They maintain that consistency in legal directives requires a single legal order consisting of international and domestic legal systems. For any two rules to be legally valid, both must be part of the same legal systems. Dualists, for their part, allow the possibility that valid legal rules conflict, or can conflict, and therefore the possibility of a plurality of independent legal orders. At the same time, monists usually claim that customary international law has domestic effect without domestic implementation. For their part, dualists frequently maintain that customary international law is not self-executing. The different positions on self-execution might seem to follow from different claims about the conditions of legal validity made by monists and dualists. This view about the relation of monism and dualism to the question of self-execution of customary international law is wrong. It conflates two different issues. Monism and dualism are views about the relation of the international legal system to domestic legal systems. They differ over the primacy and justification international law rules have over those of domestic law. Monism maintains that the norms of domestic legal systems in some way derive their validity from those of international law, while dualism claims that the validity of the norms of domestic legal systems are independent of those of international legal systems. A different issue is the priority of international law rules over those of domestic law. It's whether international law rules apply domestically without domestic authority, however the norms of these systems derive their validity. This question concerns the manner in which international law is given effect domestically. The difference between the validity of legal rules and their priority means that domestic law rules can derive their validity from international law, while in some instances being prior to it. Although it's often assumed that derived rules must be inferior to the rules from which they derive, the assumption is unsound. Derived rules sometimes can be superior to the rules from which they derive. Hans Kelsen, for instance, thinks of derivation in terms of the delegation of rulemaking authority from a higher to a lower level of authority. For him, a lower level rule is validly derived from a higher level rule when it is created in accordance with the latter rule, the higher level rule. If monism is correct, international law authorizes the enactment of domestic law rules. At the same time, international law might not consider its own rules to be self-executing. According to international law, without domestic recognition, its rules can have no domestic application. In this case, although domestic law derives from international law, domestic law takes precedence over international law. For example, customary international law obligates a party to a treaty to comply with the treaty's terms. Suppose a state is a party to a treaty which has domestic application. Suppose, too, that the state's properly enacted legislation prohibits its enforcement domestically, and the treaty is not otherwise incorporated into domestic law. Although the state violates international law and remains obligated under the treaty, international law doesn't consider the treaty to have domestic effect. This situation is fairly described as one in which international law gives domestic law priority over its own rules. Self-execution can be a norm of a single international and domestic legal order, monism, or a separate domestic legal order, dualism. Because the rule that determines whether international law is self-executing can be part of either sort of legal order, the unified character of the legal order is independent of the rule. For instance, as an analogy, the United States is a single legal order. We can think of it in that way. Article 6's Supremacy Clause makes federal law supreme over inconsistent state law. Similarly, in the European Union, community law is supreme over inconsistent national law. Federal law, therefore, applies in states, supplementing and displacing state law inconsistent with it. The fact that the United States is, or can be thought of as, a single legal order doesn't prevent federal law from being, quote, self-executing. A single legal order could contain a rule to the effect that international law doesn't have a domestic effect unless incorporated into domestic law. For instance, the Supremacy Clause could have been different. It could have made state law supreme over federal law, displacing it when the two conflicted. Alternatively, the Supremacy Clause could have stated a last-in-time rule, giving supremacy to state or federal law according to the time of its enactment or judicial recognition. This alternative rule mimics the priority rule between treaties and federal legislation. These possibilities show that a single legal order can include a rule against self-execution. Thus, the debate over whether or not distinct legal orders form a unified legal system has nothing to do with the way in which a rule applies within these orders. Whether the rule is self-executing within a legal system depends on the manner in which it applies there, not the fact that it is a part of a unified legal order. For this reason, if customary international law is self-executing, a rule in the relevant legal system allows for self-execution. The unitary character of the legal system by itself doesn't require it. Nor does self-execution dictate the relation of international to domestic law. Views that connect the place of international law in a legal order with its self-execution confuse the question of international law's primacy and justification with its priority over domestic law. To be sure, if the validity of a state's legal norms do not derive from the validity of those of international law, monism is wrong, and domestic and international law are not part of the same legal system. In that case, an international law rule providing for or against self-execution has no domestic legal effect without domestic recognition. But even if monism is correct, international law rules still might have no domestic effect either, because the single legal system doesn't by itself provide that its rules are effective domestically without domestic implementation. That requires a further step. Working monists tend to assume that the rules of customary international law are self-executing. Judge Lauterbach's statement in a case called The Case of Certain Norwegian Loans is representative. Here's what he says. The question of conformity of national legislation with international law is a matter of international law. The notion that if a matter is governed by national law, it is for that reason at the same time outside the sphere of international law is both novel and, if accepted, subversive of international law. It is not enough for a state to bring a matter under the protective umbrella of its legislation, possibly of a predatory character, in order to shelter it effectively from any control by international law. Now, Lauterbach does not explain why international law, even as part of a single legal system, has priority over inconsistent state law. Monism by itself doesn't require that customary international law control, in his terms, domestic law. This is a matter of the content of customary international law, just as Article VI's Supremacy Clause is a matter of the content of the Constitution. For this reason, positions on monism and dualism cannot always decide whether customary international law is self-executing. So I get to the end, and it's this. The conditions under which custom exists, its interpretation, and its normative force bear on the character of customs among states. However, these are matters that bear on custom generally. They don't help answer specific questions courts and other legal authorities have to answer about customary international law, its content, the legal obligations it creates, and its domestic effect. The domestic law effect. The questions here are, which customs are part of customary international law? What obligations do they impose on states? Are those norms part of domestic law? The questions are not, are these norms of customary international law, or is customary international law law? Jurisprudential theses about law, legal validity, or the relation of customary international law to domestic law don't make a difference to the answers that can be given to these legal questions. They either have nothing to say about the issues or are unnecessary to maintain in giving legally acceptable answers to them. Whether international law is self-executing cannot be determined a priori based just on the relation of international to domestic law. Similarly, legal rules can limit the authority of courts to rely on customary international law, whatever the correct conception of law turns out to be. Jurisprudence is irrelevant to both matters. Thanks.